Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Our national forests play a major economic, ecological, and recreational role in the nation and in the American West. First and foremost, they comprise roughly 200 million acres of wild forests and grasslands, an indivisible part of America's landscape. Legislatively mandated for multiple-use management, they provide timber, grazing, mineral, and recreational resources that generate tens of thousands of jobs. And their forests, lakes, and rivers enable millions of Americans to experience our natural world. Dale N. Bosworth knows something about this. He grew up in a Forest Service family, then worked for the agency for 41 years. From 2001 to 2007, he was its chief. Dale, many thanks for joining us again on Home Ground.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
It's been a while since you're on the show. Remind me about your growing up in a Forest Service family.
Well, yes, I was raised in a Forest Service family. My father was a forester in Northern California. He worked his way up the organizational levels to become a forest supervisor on the Alaska National Forest and then on the El Dorado National Forest in Northern California.
Okay, so how did that come into your life? You could have been sitting home watching TV.
Well, back in the days that I was growing up, it was common for Forest Service employees to take their sons or daughters with them out in the field and have them do some work with them while they were out there.
And that is no longer common?
And that is no longer common or allowed because of the possibility of something happening to the,
sure,
to the kid and all sorts of different reasons. But you know, when you're doing that and you're a young kid, well, you find out that some of that is kind of fun, and then also you learned that some of it was pretty boring. And so I got a little bit of a taste of both growing up and decided that that's what I wanted to do in my life. I like people, and I like the work.
When did you decide that?
I decided to go to forestry school and with an idea of working for the Forest Service when I was probably about 14 or 15 years old.
You said some was interesting, some was boring, and some was the people. If you were to summarize looking back, was there any particular experience that sticks in your mind, something that says, I really want to do this?
I don't really recall a specific incident. I would say more in a general sense that really affected me when I was like in high school was that I saw Forest Service people that just loved doing what they were doing. All they could talk about was their work. And I'd go see my friends, and their fathers were just counting the days till they could retire. I'd get around my dad and his friends, and they'd talk work all day long. And they enjoyed it, and they laughed, and they were dedicated, and they were committed to something that seemed really important to them. And that became important to me.
So you go to college and study for forestry, I guess. When did you graduate?
I graduated in 1966 from the University of Idaho.
Okay, and when did you go to work for the Forest Service?
Same year, 1966. As a permanent employee, I'd worked summers for the Forest Service.
What did you start out doing?
I started off on the St. Joe National Forest. That's what it was called at the time. It's now part of the Idaho Panhandle National Forest in northern Idaho. And I was doing tree planting, thinning, some timber sale work, just whatever needed to be done. Did some wildlife work.
At that level, I'm assuming you're taking directions from higher up. They're saying, go do this, go do that, go do this.
Oh, yeah. I was at the very, very bottom of the totem pole.
And how did it strike you? Dull, satisfying, mixed?
Oh, it was a kick. I mean, it was a lot of fun. I mean, I enjoyed it a lot. It was hard work. You know, we were out camped out all week long laying out timber sales, or we were planting trees from dawn to dusk, or we were doing thinning projects, firefighting, some trail work. But it was just a lot of fun learning every day.
Okay, when did you move up and to do what?
Well, I was there on the St. Joe for 2 or 3 years. I moved over to the Colville National Forest, got a promotion, so then I was doing the same kind of work, only I had a couple people that reported to me, and so I started supervising some others, and eventually I became a district ranger, which is a person who's in charge of one of the units of a national forest. I think there's more authority for a district ranger than some people sometimes think there is. A district ranger is responsible for everything that goes on that person's ranger district, which is usually anywhere from 2 or 3 or 400,000 acres to 1 million acres.
That's a lot of land.
It's a lot of land. They have to follow the standards and guidelines of that are in their forest plans. They have to follow the manual, which the Forest Service manual system, which is basically interpretation of the laws that we have to follow. And there's policy issues that have been worked out that the district ranger has to follow the Forest Service policy.
Okay, you become a district ranger when?
I was a district ranger in 1976.
Okay. There's a word in the English language called bureaucracy. And if you hear criticisms, and I'm not saying everybody's a critic of the Forest Service, but the ones that are, will often say it's bureaucratic, slow-moving, et cetera, not responsive to the needs of X, Y, or Z, depending who's talking. Was that your experience? There was a lot of bureaucracy, or would you say that there was an appropriate chain of command that still allowed for creativity and professional expertise on the part of the people that worked with you?
Well, I think there was an opportunity for creativity and for people to be able to exercise their own ideas and thinking and work with the public and get projects done. But at the same time, any organization that gets large, whether it's a public organization or private company, pretty soon you start to see the bureaucracy creep in. And so the Forest Service has a lot of bureaucratic kinds of problems that I think that are associated with it.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with former Chief of the United States Forest Service, Dale Bosworth. On that issue, you worked for the Forest Service for 41 years, and I think most people would say in any government agency or private entity that's large, you're looking for both creative professional expertise and you're looking for following certain rules. You're not a lone ranger, okay? There's a balance in there. Has that balance changed in the Forest Service over the period of time you worked with it, in your view, in any respect, for better or worse, and if so, how?
Yes, I think it has changed some. I mean, there's been more and more laws have been passed, more and more rules and regulations, and so it makes it more and more difficult for the Forest Service to get work done on the ground without having to go through a huge amount of paperwork and analysis and process. That part isn't good. I will say that I think the Forest Service makes better decisions today than we did back in the 1960s and 70s.
That sounds almost contradictory.
Yeah, it is a bit. But the fact is that the decisions are better decisions because we understand more, we have better science behind them. But we spend way too much time and money doing the analysis and going through the process to make those decisions.
Let's talk about that. You mentioned a forest plan. As a district ranger, you have to carry out the forest plan. Those are two words that don't mean much to me and don't mean much to my listeners. What is a forest plan? How is it developed?
A forest plan is a requirement by law under the National Forest Management Act, and it's a requirement to develop a plan for each individual administrative unit or national forest, basically a national forest, that will last 10 to 15 years. The requirement is for the public to be heavily involved in that plan. And that plan then would lay out where you could harvest timber, where you can have certain kinds of recreation, what the requirements would be if you do special use permits. It's a general plan, long-term plan for the national forest.
Is it fair to call it a blueprint with some discretion?
It's a blueprint with some discretion. Yes, that'd be very good. It has standards and guidelines that that the Forest Service has to follow if they're going to do certain projects.
It sounds to me like that basic structure of a Forest Service plan makes sense to you. Is a workable approach. Is that fair?
Yes, it is. It's a workable approach. It's a good approach. Forest plans are very helpful. The public has been very involved in developing them. The difficulty, in my view, is in the implementation of the forest plan.
Why is that a problem?
It's because the Forest Service turns right around through the requirements and has to go through another huge amount of analysis and spend a huge amount of money to develop a thinning project for for fire or something, to reduce the fire fuels, or to do a project of a fisheries project or wildlife habitat improvement. Any project they go through, they have to do a huge amount of analysis, and they can't just jump out there and get the work done really quickly. Even though they have this forest plan they developed, and the public has been involved with that, even though they've had a collaborative group in many cases work together to help the Forest Service design a project, they still have to take another year or 2 years or 3 years to go through the environmental impact statement and develop that. And that's a waste of money. And they don't have enough money to do all that kind of work and get the job done on the ground too.
So what's the origin of what I'm hearing you say from your perspective is a duplication of effort that's very costly in time, money, and staff? What's the origin of that?
Well, through the legislation that's been passed, things like the National Forest Management Act, the National Environmental Policy Act that were passed back in the 70s and 60s and 70s, and then the regulations that were promulgated to implement those laws.
Okay.
And there's a lot of laws. I mean, they're all kind of overlapping that makes that adds burden to getting the job done.
There's a group of people who believe, if they look back, and we all tend to look in the past to form values, that let's say in the 1980s, the Forest Service responded to commodity interests and heavily logged, let's say the Bitterroot as an example, a lot of clear cuts, a lot of roads, that those folks think were damaging to the integrity of the forest. So they would say, perhaps if they're sitting at this table, we need these extra reviews because those guys can't be trusted. Left to their own, they're going to clear cut the national forest, do bad things again. What do you say to them?
Well, I mean, I just completely disagree. It's a different time. It's a different place. Doctors used to bleed their patients, but we still go to the doctor. You know, they used to put leeches on their patients. We don't think that's a good idea anymore, and neither do doctors. Foresters used to do a whole lot more different kinds of clear-cutting, and things that we've learned through science and through public involvement are not things that we want to do in the same way. There's no whole bunch of foresters out there in the Forest Service that are lurking behind trees just wanting to cut them down. That's not the way it is in the outfit these days.
And the other side of the argument might come from timber-dependent communities or people who work in the woods that say, in the good old days, we could go out and cut trees down and supply our mills. Now they're all wrapped up in paperwork. We're not getting things done that need to get done. The forest is overgrown, fire-prone, disastrous fires. We could do a lot of thinning. It's not happening. What do you say to those folks?
Well, it certainly isn't happening. The amount of work that needs to be done on the ground is not happening as fast as it should be. I agree with that. Although I would also say we don't want to go back to those so-called good old days of heavy timber harvest. I really think the Forest Service can produce more wood fiber by accident, doing the kinds of thinning projects that need to be done to take care of fire and to restore the forest. They can produce more by accident than what we've been able to do on purpose for the last few years.
Let me see if I understand you. When you use the word accident, you're saying that, let's say, a restoration project to put back ponderosa pine or restore quake and aspen in an historic zone produces timber, not as the first purpose, but in fact as a byproduct of the activity.
By accident, what I mean is that that's not necessarily our primary purpose. Our primary purpose would be to do restoration work, say.
Right.
And when you're doing some of that restoration, there will be some wood fiber, small diameter trees, or even larger trees that would be removed to meet the objectives of the land. And I believed and still believe for a long time that what we really ought to be focusing on is what we leave on the land to make sure that we're leaving the right kinds of things that need to be left on the land. And then what you take doesn't seem to be quite so important.
You mentioned the Forest Service is using better science than it used to, and I remember being surprised when I was in Washington a few years ago that you have a very substantial science, I'll call it, division in the Forest Service, correct? And if so, what does it do?
Yeah, it is correct. We have a very competent, quite large research and development organization. It's what we call a deputy area in the Forest Service. It's independent from the National Forest System, works directly for the chief of the Forest Service. And that we have some examples right, you know, here in Montana, the Northern Region Fire Lab, that's located in Missoula, has done some of the best fire research in the country for years and years. The Forest Service has been doing research on climate change since the 80s and how forests play into climate change and can deal with climate change. There's all sorts of research from fisheries and from water quality and from wildlife and recreation users and users' desires that's been going on in the Forest Service for years and years and years.
And is it your experience that science is applied as opposed to left on bookshelves?
It's applied. I mean, I feel, you know, sometimes not as quickly as it should be, but Forest Service people who are doing, the managers who are doing the work on the ground, have quick access now to research papers that have been published. They want to know, they want to base their work on good science and the best science, and so they're after it, and they do it.
Going back to your view that there's excessive paperwork and analysis required, One of the issues that's come up fairly, not recently, it's been a pretty hot issue for a while, is litigation against the Forest Service over proposed timber sales and restoration actions, et cetera. What's your sense for it? Because on one side, people are saying it's tying up the agency. Some of the litigators say it's like 14% in this area or that area, and it sounds like a rather minor percentage of sales. What's your experience?
Well, the difficulty is that every project is affected by lawsuits. Not every project has a suit filed against it, but the Forest Service has to treat every project that they're going to do or that they're doing as if it were going to have a lawsuit filed against it. So they have to do this huge amount of paperwork to bulletproof it, we call it, to make sure that if a suit is filed or some kind of objection is filed, that we'll be able to win. And so that affects every project. Now, over the years, I used to ask for supervisors when I was visiting the field and I was talking to supervisors, I'd say, how much time did you spend before you were ready to make a decision that you believe you would have been proud of, would have been based on good scientists, that you could have held your head up high and made that decision? How far through the process were you? And I would say that almost all of them said somewhere between 35 and 45% of the time that they had worked on the project that they were ready to make a decision and go ahead and implement. But because of the requirements, they had to spend another 60% of the money making sure all the I's are dotted and all the T's were crossed.
Would you say that this is a significant burden that inhibits the Forest Service from getting the stewardship done that should be done on the land or not?
I believe it's a significant burden. I believe that the Forest Service does not have adequate funding to do the work. And therefore, if you could reduce the amount of time they're spending in the office and increase the amount of time they're spending on the ground getting work done, that would be a good thing.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with former Chief of the United States Forest Service, Dale Bosworth. You mentioned money. We've just come through a congressional session where the issue of Forest Service budgeting was national news for a fairly prolonged period of time. I'm going to try to summarize it. If I do an inadequate job, you correct me. The focal point was on the largely accelerated amount of money over a period of decades required from the Forest Service's budget to be spent fighting wildfire. And my understanding is, if I can believe what I've read, that the diversion of that money has caused serious cutbacks in staffing for your agency. Do I have that basically right?
Yeah, you do. Back in the 1990s, I believe that something like 15% of the Forest Service's, 15% of the Forest Service's budget was spent on fire. Today, it's close to 50%. Therefore, there's a big chunk of money that used to go to things like trails and recreation and timber management and restoration kinds of work, wildlife habitat improvement, and so on, that's no longer, and as well as research and some of those kinds of programs too, that's no longer being done and no longer have staffing to do that work.
Okay, my understanding was that the goal was to try to provide an alternative source of funding, as we do for floods, for example, or earthquakes. If there's a big forest fire, it doesn't come out of your budget, it comes from somewhere else, which seems to make common sense, but apparently didn't make common sense enough to get a permanent solution. What happened in Congress?
Well, as I understand it, that it didn't get passed. I mean, the idea would be that if a fire gets to a certain size, then instead of coming out of the Forest Service's budget, it would be paid for sort of like earthquakes and tornadoes and the aftermath of hurricanes and so on, rather than just having the agency try to suck it up from their regular funding. There just hasn't been the kind of agreement in Congress that's needed to be able to solve those kinds of problems. But it's a huge problem for the Forest Service.
My recollection is from reading some of the press around this that over the past decade there's been a 35% reduction in Forest Service staff. Does that ring a bell?
Well, I don't know the exact numbers, but that sounds logical, reasonable to me about what I would expect. There's been a significant reduction in staffing on all programs except for fire. And of course, there's been an increase in firefighters, an increase in fire staffing. You know, that's where the big increases have been.
Simply as a citizen that values the national forests, and I've benefited from participation in it as a hunter and fisherman basically all my life, the idea that the budgetary capacity to provide high-quality stewardship would be eroded over time to fight fires, frankly, offends me. It suggests to me that your agency's responsibility to do the job for the American people may be in serious jeopardy. Is that an exaggerated perception?
No, it offends me too, and I think the perception is exactly right. You know, when you think back about it, a large part of the West was built from our national forests. You know, railroads were built by taking, you know, the wood from the national forest. Communities, homes were built in the small towns up and throughout the interior West, coming from the national forest, grazing, livestock taking place on what's now our national forest. And yet, we don't want to reinvest in that for our future generations. So we're just going to cut back on the funding and let the future generations fend for themselves. That offends me.
That, I think, strikes a pretty grim note. Are there techniques that the Forest Service, recognizing Congress has failed to fix the problem, may fail in the future? Are there ways that you can enhance your capacity with your existing staff resources?
Well, I think that a large part of the future of the Forest Service's hopefully success is going to be with working with collaborative groups.
What does a collaborative group mean to you?
To me, a collaborative group is a group of diverse interests that care about the national forest that they're interested in, that come together to try to resolve their differences and to agree on specific projects that can be done on the ground to improve the situation, whether it be habitat improvement or whether it be a timber sale or fire restoration, whatever it is. They come together, they work together, and they come to agreement, and the Forest Service, as a part of that, would then move forward and implement that project.
Our listeners may know that I have done a fair amount of facilitative work for such collaborative groups, so I may have a bias. My experience in Montana, and that is my only direct personal experience, is that there have been significant successes in bringing groups as diverse as the Sierra Club and the Montana Wood Products Association together to come up with those kind of projects, which may surprise people. Did it surprise you?
Well, you know, I'd say that I've been a little bit surprised in some areas of the country where I would have thought that it was just never going to happen. You'd never get people together and to work on it, and they are working together. So I find it encouraging. What I think we really need is we need some maybe policy or legislation that would encourage environmental groups to come together and be an incentive for them to work together, as opposed to if we have some things that are kind of disincentives. I mean, a group of people with their own, taking their own time, come together and work for a year or 2 years and come to agreement with people who disagree with them. That's amazing. And then the Forest Service has to take 2 or 3 years to develop an environmental impact statement and then maybe go through a court, you know, that might get sued, and so they may still have to go to court or whatever. That's not a very good incentive for people to come back again the next year and start working on another project.
Well, let me see if I understand you. You're saying that if environmental, let's say, and industry groups come together and come up with a solution, it's reasonable that there would be an expedited process for review by the Forest Service.
That's exactly what I'm saying, that if a project has been done with a collaborative, then I would say maybe up to certain sideboards, maybe a categorical exclusion could be used to implement the project, or maybe only one action alternative and no action alternative would all that would be considered in the environmental document.
Those are technical statements, but what they mean to me is a simplified environmental review process, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Critics of collaboratives make the case that any reduction in environmental review cuts the public out of the process. What would be your response to that argument?
I just don't think that's true. First, with the collaborative groups, people have an option of being a part of a collaborative group. They've decided they don't want to do that. They've decided they don't want to work with other people. So they've cut themselves out. Then people need to remember that when somebody files a lawsuit, the rest of the public is left out of the process. The rest of the public is not involved in working out an agreement with the appellant or with the person who filed the suit.
I see.
They're left out of the process. So if anybody's getting left out of the process, it's not the one. It's not the environmental communities that don't elect to be part of the collaborative process.
So what was your sense for why it didn't happen this time in Congress? It seems common sense.
Well, it does seem common sense, and I felt like we had pretty good support for some of the changes that I think are the right changes from the Montana delegation and from a lot of people around the country that really cared, and it was bipartisan. But for whatever reason, two key senators were not in agreement, and that ended it.
Yeah, one was Republican, one was Democrat.
One was a Republican, one was a Democrat.
You served in the Forest Service for 41 years, starting at the bottom and ending at the top. You care about it. As you look forward, are you optimistic, pessimistic, or hopeful that the combination of Forest Service professionals controlled legislatively by the United States Congress and the President of the United States is going to be a model that can work or will work well in the future? Are you worried? Are you darn worried? What would you say, frankly, to the American people?
I guess I would say I'm hopeful. It's going to take a lot of changes to get where the Forest Service needs to be. And I'm hopeful partly. I think it's becoming more bipartisan. There are more and more Democrats and Republicans that are wanting to work together on this kind of an issue and have agreement. And I see more and more the environmental community wanting to work with timber industry and others, finding common ground. And I think that's important. And so the more we go that way, I mean, that's what gives me hope, because the further we go where we have people from a variety of viewpoints that say, hey, it is the right thing to work together. We can get this done. We can make the forests healthier and safer and better condition and still protect all the things that they provide for us. And so more people are seeing that. They're wanting to work together, so I'm hopeful.
Dale Bosworth, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much again for being on Home Ground. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And more fundamentally, I want to thank you for your service to the nation and the national forests of the people of the United States. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.